we can show that 70% of people have meaningful reduction in fatigue, improvement in quality of life just by addressing their diet. In my therapeutic lifestyle clinic at the VA, we could get 80% of folks with just really basic primary care labs that we could do in the VA system in dealing with modifiable lifestyle factors. In my private practice, when I can investigate more thoroughly and optimize all the factors more thoroughly, we have a remarkable success rate.
Hi, everybody. Dr. Amy Myers with the Take Back Your Health podcast. Today, I'd like to welcome our guest, Dr. Terry Walls, who is an old dear friend of mine. She is also an Institute for Functional Medicine certified practitioner. She conducts clinical trials in the setting of multiple sclerosis, or MS. In 2018, she was awarded the Institute for Functional Medicine Linus Pauling Award for her contribution in research, clinical care, and patient advocacy. She is the author of The Walls Protocol, a radical new way to treat all chronic autoimmune conditions using paleo principles, and the cookbook, The Walls Protocol, Cooking for Life. To learn more about a current study that she's conducting, the efficacy of diet on quality of life in multiple sclerosis, please visit terrywalls.com/MS study. You can find Dr. Walls on Instagram at Dr. Terry Walls and also Facebook at Terry Walls. Before we get into this week's interview, just a quick reminder that we've created a special offer specifically for listeners of this show on your very first purchase of any of my products on amymyersmd.com. Simply enter promo code TAKEBACK15 at checkout and you'll receive a 15% discount on your first AMMD purchase. That's promo code TAKEBACK15 at amymyersmd.com. All right. Well, everybody, we have Dr. Terry Walls here. Terry Walls and I go way back. I think our books came out about the same time. We've been to many a conference together and had many a meal together. So I'm very excited to have you as a guest on Take Back Your Health podcast.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Well, I know your story, but for the listeners who are new to our podcast and may not know of you, could you kind of tell us first your background, but also your personal story? You have a personal story with MS, and we'd love to hear it.
So I'm an internal medicine doc. I was here at the University of Iowa in the Iowa City VA, and I had developed weakness in my left leg. So dragging it, get home. Then I see the neurologist who does the exam and says, you know, Terry, this could be bad or really, really bad. And so for the next 3 weeks, I'm going through my workup and I'm thinking about the fact I've already had 20 years of worsening electrical face pain due to trigeminal neuralgia. Oh. And so actually I'm praying for a rapidly fatal diagnosis because I don't want to become disabled. 3 weeks later, I get the spinal tap and the conclusion is I have relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis. I do my research. I find the best MS center in the country. I see their best physician. I take the newest drugs. 3 years later, I hear tilt recline wheelchair. And I take mitoxantrone, a form of chemotherapy. That does not help. Then I take Tysabri, the new biologic. That does not help. And then I'm switched to CellCept. And then I ask myself a really big question. Am I doing all that I can? And I go back to reading the basic science. And I start developed the theory that mitochondrial dysfunction is what drives disability. And I start taking a supplement cocktail that to support my mitochondria. And it helps, you know, a little bit. I'm super grateful, but I'm still declining. Then I'm called into my chief of staff's office and he tells me he's going to reassign me to the traumatic brain injury clinic come January, 6 months in the future, describes the job. And I know I'm not going to be able to do that job. So I'm upset, but like, okay, that's what it's going to be. Then I discover a study using electrical stimulation of muscles and convince my physical therapist to give me a test session. It hurts really bad, but then I feel great. And he says, we add the electrical stimulation to my physical therapy, and I do that every day. And then 2 weeks later, I discover the Institute for Functional Medicine, and they have a course in neuroprotection. I take their course. I have a longer list of supplements. And then I have a really big aha. Amy and I laugh at how long it took to have this. I'd already adopted the paleo diet for 5 years. But what if I redesign my paleo diet based on the supplements that I'm taking and where those ingredients are in the food supply? And so that's more research. And in December of 07, I start this new diet. And for you all the listeners, I want you to know how disabled I am at that point. I cannot sit up, but it's been years since I could sit up. I'm in a zero gravity chair with my knees higher than my nose. That's how I staff clinics with the residents. That's how I take my meals at home. I can't go out to restaurants. I can't go to movies. And we basically drive to Wisconsin with me laying horizontal in the car. I'm beginning to have brain fog. And my trigeminal neuralgia is relentlessly more difficult. So I clearly understand that I'm on track to become bedridden by my illness, probably demented by my illness, and probably have my trigeminal neuralgia turn permanently on, such that light, sound, even when it's on, moving my tongue triggers the pain. So I'm drooling and I'm unable to communicate.
And let me just, you mentioned the year. Do you mind sharing how old you were at this point?
52.
52. So, I mean, very young, prime of your life, frankly.
Prime of my life. I'm diagnosed when I'm 45. I'm in the wheelchair when I'm 48. When I'm 52, it's clear I'm going to be forced into medical retirement. I'm clearly going to be a burden for my family. It's a very grim future.
Mm-hmm. And you're still on how many drugs at this point?
Well, you know, I'm taking maximum dose gabapentin, baclofen. I'm taking Cellcept, which is a transplant drug. Mm-hmm. I failed mitoxantrone. I failed Tysabri.
And then you have this cocktail as well. Do you mind sharing the cocktail at the time that you were taking for your mitochondria?
I was taking B vitamins, creatine, carnitine, lipoic acid, coenzyme Q. And I was also taking magnesium, zinc, and of course, omega-3s. And, you know, then January comes, I have to start this new clinic, the traumatic brain injury clinic. The first 2 weeks, I'm just going to watch for my Toby Klein wheelchair. And then the third week comes, and when I get home on Monday, I tell Jack, you know, that wasn't too bad. And then I also say, I'd like to try sitting at the table in a regular chair. So we take away my zero gravity chair and we bring my regular chair and I have supper with my family.
Wow.
First time in years. And then at the end of the week on Friday, I tell Jack, I think I can do this. This wasn't too bad. And my physical therapist says, Terry, you are definitely getting stronger. I want you to do your exercises 10 minutes twice a day now. And then it's 15 minutes twice a day, then 20 minutes twice a day. And then I take my two walking sticks and I walk in the hallways at the hospital with my walking sticks. And of course, my partners are like, oh my God, they're so amazed. And then I'm walking with one walking stick and then with none.
And so at this point, you had changed your diet.
Right. So I had been basically following the AIP diet for 4 years and I continued to go downhill.
Okay. And so what was this change in diet?
Well, this change was much more focused on what to eat as opposed what to not eat.
Got it.
I'd already been meticulously about what to not eat for years, but now it's much more focused on more greens, more organ meat. I added more seaweed, more vegetables, more mushrooms, more nutritional yeast, a lot more fermented foods. And what is remarkable is the speed at which these changes happened, mm-hmm. Amy. So
incredible.
From December to May, I go from being unable to sit up to walking the neighborhood. You know, it's still a half mile. It's, you know, that's a big walk, a huge walk for me. And I tell Jackie, I want to try riding my bike. And she says, well, you know, maybe if things keep going well, maybe in the fall. And 2 weeks later on Mother's Day, I really want to try riding my bike. So we have an emergency family meeting. And Jackie tells my son, Zach, who's 6'5", he's 16. Zach, you run alongside on the left. And she tells Zebby, who's 13, you run alongside on the right. And she'll follow. And I get on my bike. and I bike around the block. And that big 16-year-old boy, he's crying. Zebby, my 13-year-old, she's crying.
Still Jackie's very emotional. Crying.
And of course, as I relive that moment, I still cry, because when you have progressive MS, you let go of the future. You take each day as it unfolds, and I had let go of my future. It wasn't until I had got on my bike that it was like, how much recovery might be possible? And so every day, I biked a little bit more. And then in October, Jackie comes home and says, honey, I signed us up for the Courage Ride. It's 18.5 miles. However far you go will be great. And I crossed that finish line. And of course, we're all crying again. My kids are crying, Jackie's crying, I'm crying. And this fundamentally changes how I think about disease and health. It will change how I practice medicine. It will change the focus of my research. And I've made it my mission now to teach other clinicians and to teach the public that there is a whole lot we can do. Even when your physicians say, there's nothing more that I've got to offer you.
And what did your physician say? Did they think that the medicine had suddenly, spontaneously started to work? Were they interested in diet?
My neurologist was amazed. He was thrilled when I walked in. We got an MRI, and he's like, well, nothing's changed. That's super interesting. But of course, these are all old lesions. You've not had a new lesion in a very long time. But clearly, your brain has rewired itself. Your spinal cord has rewired itself. And we would ultimately start doing clinical trials. He joined me on my clinical trials. My chief of staff ultimately became a huge champion and supported my doing a clinical trial, testing my protocol in others with secondary and primary progressive MS.
Well, I mean, as a physician and also a person who has suffered from MS, that's autoimmunity, not MS. I don't have MS, knock on wood. I find that pretty incredible that you have, you know, been able to sway others and get support of your own doctor. Because when I was in practice, the number of people, as I'm sure you have witnessed yourself, that do your program, do my program, their autoimmunity reverses, and they're just poo-pooed by their regular doctor. So that's
what really helped. My chief of medicine at the university was a rheumatologist. And he had called me in and said, you know, Terry, I want you to start to do a safety feasibility study. And he called John, my chief of staff. They spoke and they were supportive. And so we did that first trial. And we kept doing little pilot studies, publishing them. And every year there is the Internal Medicine Research Day, Carver College of Medicine Research Day. We'd present our research, have our posters. And then I started presenting our data to neurology into various departments around the university.
And I am so fascinated to hear about your research, because I know you're doing such exciting work. Yeah. Before we get there, can we just, I mean, you frankly have just described MS, but can you tell the listeners who might be new to it, what exactly is MS?
Yeah, so it's a combination of degeneration and inflammation. And the first drugs were all about the inflammation and turning off our immune system, because there's evidence that the immune cells are attacking the myelin, leading to relapses, that is acute worsening of MS sensory or motor symptoms that slowly improve. And then beginning around age 40, when our immune systems begin to decline and we begin to age and fall apart, as aging really begins around age 40, then we go from having relapses to not having relapses and just having this slow, steady decline, and you enter the progressive phase of the illness. So I was diagnosed at age 45, and basically I had perhaps two relapses the whole time. Otherwise, I had this slow, relentless decline. And most people will stop having relapses sometime between age 45 and 55 and be just have this slow decline, more anxiety, more depression, more brain fog, more fatigue, more difficulty walking, more difficulty using their hands. We have great drugs that turn off the relapses, that turn off the new enhancing lesions. All these great drugs cannot stop the decline. They pushed it a little 5 years further into the future. So instead of 40 to 50, it's 45 to 55 that most people end up in the secondary progressive phase of the illness.
In your experience and, you know, working with many patients, do you believe that this purely is genetic? Do you believe, you know, what?
So let me comment on that. So you have to have genes that put you at risk for probably 200 to 300 different genes. And it's slightly different genes, whether you're talking Hashimoto's or lupus or RA, inflammatory bowel disease, or MS. The vast majority of people with those genes don't get the particular autoimmune disease in question. So you have the genes. Next thing that happens is you have an infection. We've all heard a lot about Epstein-Barr, but there are 15 other viruses and bacteria that increase the risk for an autoimmune process. And then those environmental factors. And we know these, and this is where my conventional colleagues will say, well, we don't know what the environmental factors are, so just take the drugs. Take the drugs. You and I would say, well, but we know the environmental factors associated with health and disease. So we're going to help you address all those environmental factors and shift them towards a more health-promoting state and away from disease-promoting state. So we're talking about nutrition, talking about stress management, talking about exercise, about social connections, purpose. And then, according to the resources, I may investigate nutrient levels, toxin exposures, hormonal balance, and I'll optimize all those factors. Mm-hmm. Now, what is super interesting, Amy, is that in our clinical trials, we can show that 70% of people have meaningful reduction in fatigue, improvement in quality of life, just by addressing their diet. In my therapeutic lifestyle clinic at the VA, we could get 80% of folks with just really basic primary care labs that we could do in the VA system in dealing with modifiable lifestyle factors. In my private practice, and I'm sure that this would be the same for you, is when I can investigate more thoroughly and optimize all the factors more thoroughly, we have a remarkable success rate. And the earlier that you come work with us, the easier it is. If you wait late into your disease with advanced disability, I can still make a big difference. It's going to take a lot more work to get functional recovery.
And when you're doing nutritional interventions, obviously, I assume you're working towards the mitochondria and supporting them, as you said that you did for yourself with the organ meats and the greens and things like that. Are you still also focused on eliminating foods? You know, do you see the connection such as gluten or dairy as being big trigger foods?
So for the vast majority of folks, gluten and dairy are big problems. And depending on other comorbid issues, we might be restricting nightshades, legumes, and grains. And I also have to have a conversation what the family can do, because diet as a family intervention will be successful. Diet as a single intervention, while I'm watching the family continue to eat the standard American diet, is going to be a failure.
Absolutely.
So we have a big conversation, what support looks like, what we can negotiate as a family to add, what we can negotiate as a family to eliminate from the eating environment of the patient. Now, that may mean that the adolescent children, when they go to school with their friends, they're going to eat what they want. And the spouse, when they are not in the eating environment of the patient, they eat what they want, but they don't come home and talk about it. They don't come home and say, like, oh my God, that pizza and beer was so good.
Right. So I have two quick questions for you. Do you have MS patients that, I mean, they may eat gluten because they want to, but do you have any that you don't recommend getting off gluten? Or is that a unit? I mean, for me, if you have an autoimmune condition, I say absolutely.
I don't want to get on gluten. No. Yeah.
Right. And then you brought up children. So I'm kind of curious of your perspective, if the mother per se, or we could even equate it maybe to your own family. You have two children. If the mother or father has an autoimmune condition, MS, do you recommend that the children, I hear at home to help support the family member, they want to be gluten-free, dairy-free. But do you recommend, in order to potentially prevent any autoimmune condition or MS from coming out, to be gluten-free?
Well, so that's a super interesting question. My preference will be that the whole household be gluten-free. Right. And then we have a conversation about dairy and the cross-reaction between gluten and dairy. And if they are going to have dairy, then we'll talk about goat and sheep, camel dairy. Mm-hmm. But, you know, part of the problem is this cross-reactivity, and these dairy proteins have molecular mimicry, yes, with human brain proteins. And so I recommend, when we wean our children, and certainly when growth plates fuse, to have other sources for your calcium and your protein.
And of course, know what molecular mimicry is, but could you explain that to our listeners?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So our immune cells recommend the sequences of amino acids. That's the smallest subunit of a protein. And if you have a same amino acid sequence in gluten and in the dairy protein casein, your body will react to both compounds. And we know it, the casein, that is the dairy amino acid sequence, has similar sequences to brain structures in the cerebellum. And so that has a big impact on balance and on motor function. It also has impact on mood regulation. So for that reason, people with autoimmunity and a neurologic or psychiatric symptom, I really want them to be dairy-free.
Yes. The non-negotiables for me as a person with a history of autoimmunity, and also what I recommend to my patients, are no gluten, no dairy, never. So I'm kind of curious for you. Our programs are very similar in terms of what to take away. Mm-hmm. And I write about the autoimmune spectrum, meaning that when you're high up on this spectrum, your markers are elevated, your symptoms are flaring, you absolutely want to be doing the diet to a T. And as you are able to reduce those, your symptoms are going away, your antibodies are going away, you might be able to branch out, not to gluten or dairy, but maybe to some grains, legumes, on occasion, a gluten-free, dairy-free cupcake at your birthday. What is your philosophy on that? Is it rigid no matter what? Or is there flexibility?
First, we have to get you to fully recover. We want to have whatever the markers are for your autoimmune disease go away. And so that if you have titers, autoantibody titers, that's easier to follow. For MS, no lesions, no relapses, doing well. And then we can begin. Then I go through a period of training them on their subtle symptoms, so they can be aware of that they're having a subtle indication of more disease activity. I am like, okay, I liberalized my diet and my vision is not as good. My tremor is back. I'm stumbling again. I'm having that MS hug, that painful torsal pain. That's a signal that your food triggers, or maybe toxin exposures, there was wildfire in your area, or the financial strain that's happening in your household, or the spouse who's drinking is becoming a problem again. That, so it's not just food triggers, but there may be other triggers.
Yes.
So ideally, I want to have people have their diet as liberalized as we can, so it's to the least restrictive. But I want them to be trained so that they can monitor their symptoms to know. I also find that some folks are like, I feel so good. I'm not at all interested in bringing these foods back. I like my diet. We have plenty of variety. I'm very happy. And we have some folks who end up on a ketogenic diet. They're very happy on a ketogenic diet, and they're not at all interested in liberalizing. So it depends on the person, depends on the family. Ideally, the least restrictive diet and the diet that the family can sustain.
And I've shared many a meal with you and been in other countries with you, and you post a lot about the delicious meals that you're making at home. What does Dr. Terry Walls have to celebrate her birthday?
Well, liver and onions.
Okay.
You know, of course.
All right. So you stick to it even on your birthday. Not even an almond flour cupcake?
No, not at all.
Not at all.
Never. And there are so many really tasty, delicious, keto-friendly, paleo-friendly foods, but they're mostly processed foods. I would rather people eat protein, you know, meat, fish, poultry, vegetables, sauerkraut, kimchi, some heart, or, I mean, heart is so delicious. Tongue is so delicious. Liver prepared correctly is so delicious. And my family knows that liver and onions is one of my favorite meals. And so they will make that for me on my birthday.
That's wonderful. Where do you get clean sources? Do you have a local farmer you work with or butcher?
So I'm a farm kid. And so I really like being able to buy my meat from local farmers. Mm-hmm. There's a farmer, bison farmer from Western Iowa. He drives over with his van. And so we'll get a half bison, which does take us a while to eat a whole bison. And so we'll do that, and we'll get poultry, again, from local farmers. And I realize that not everyone can do that. And I also want to make the observation that when I was still at the VA, still seeing patients, and the VA had pulled me out of primary care, we had created the Therapeutic Lifestyle Clinic, and we were seeing the sickest people, really, because I'd gone to the pain clinic, specialty medicine. I said, give me your sickest people that you can't seem to help, and I'll take care of them, but I'm not going to be using drugs. It's all going to be diet and lifestyle. And we had remarkable success. And so these veterans were living in rural Iowa, rural Missouri, rural Illinois, shopping in these small grocery stores or small convenience stores. They weren't getting organic foods. They were beginning to grow their own gardens and get venison from their friends who were still hunting. And they had remarkable success. Mm-hmm. So yes, organic is ideal. Grass-fed is ideal. But just do the best that you can given your economic reality. Quit buying processed foods. Start buying these radical things our grandmothers knew as cabbages, onions, dried mushrooms, meat. You can talk, if you're here in the Midwest, there are too many deer everywhere. And there are a lot of folks who are hunters. You can get venison pretty easily. It becomes much more affordable than you realize.
Excellent advice. Well, let's switch over to your research now. I know that you have a clinical trial going on, or one that's been going on. You want to tell us about that, please?
So before I do, I'm going to mention one study that just came out, a quasi-experimental study, newly diagnosed MS patients who declined disease-modifying treatments that were trained on basically the modified paleo diet, or the Walls paleo diet, a 4-7-8 breathing, and a walking program. And the comparison group were people newly diagnosed with MS who were taking disease-modifying treatments and could eat what they wanted. And we compared the outcomes for those two groups. We started our enrollment March 2020, which, as you would all remember, is when the pandemic started. And we had to convert the study into a virtual-only study with only patient-reported outcomes. The patient-reported outcomes between the two groups were statistically equivalent. Then there's another technique called a non-inferiority analysis to see, was the health behaviors arm not worse than the DMT arm? And the answer is, it wasn't. For fatigue measures, for anxiety, for depression, for quality of life, and for mental clarity as measured by perceived deficits. So super exciting. I wish we could have had our brain MRIs. That would have been even better, but you know, God intervened, so we weren't able to get those.
And how many people? Excellent. Congratulations.
We had 29 in health behaviors, 15 in the control arm.
Awesome. And have you continued to follow them?
We will follow them for another 3 years. And so it'll be, about 3 years before I'll be able to report out what we're going to see on that. Now, the study that we are recruiting for now is a study for people with relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis between the ages of 18 and 70 who are willing to come to Iowa City at month 0, month 3, month 24. We're comparing a ketogenic diet, a modified paleo diet, and usual diet. If you're already on a therapeutic diet, as long as you're willing to be randomized to one of these three diets, we can have you in the study. So if you're already on a ketogenic diet, you can still screen and be in the study. You just have to be willing that if you're randomized to the paleo diet, you will in fact switch from the ketogenic diet to the paleo diet. And if you're on a Mediterranean diet, you're willing to say, you know what, if I get randomized to keto or paleo, I will abandon the Mediterranean diet and I'll get trained in the diet which I've been assigned, and that's what I'll do. You can learn more about this, terrywalls.com/MS study. Please screen. And we will ask, give us your name and contact information. You'll be able to say that you want to be part of our database for other studies, because we do studies that are survey-based only that don't require travel. So I want everyone to screen so you can be in the database for future studies. And then hopefully you'd also be willing to come get randomized and be part of our clinical trial.
Now, can any of these people be on prescription medications for MS?
Yeah. So, okay. And if you're on a DMT, and in fact, I would say about 3/4 of the folks in our study are on a DMT. We want you to stay on your DMT. And if your medical team says, for whatever reason, I want to change you from DMT-A to DMT-B, we want you to follow your neurologist's advice and go ahead and make that change. And if during the study you come in and you're not on a DMT and you decide for whatever reason that you want to start a DMT while you're in the study, yes, you can do that as well.
Okay. And now, Terry, where do you get your funding for these studies?
Well, so the funding for this study is from a private grateful patient and a fund from her and their family foundation. So we are very grateful. We have had the MS Society fund some of our trials. We've had a nonprofit from Canada fund several of our trials. And we've had grateful patients, and we've had people contacting us making small $5 donations, $100 donations. So we do have links. If you go to terrywalls.com, if you want, if you believe in what I'm doing, we'd love to have you support our trials.
Are you a nonprofit? Are you classified? I mean, do people who make these donations get a tax deduction?
Yes. So as a matter of fact, the University of Iowa has the Dr. Terry Walls Research Fund, which is a nonprofit. And so there's a link, terrywalls.com, when you go to about the research, so you can donate there. In the university, we'll give you the charitable contribution forms.
So why do you think that there are not more studies on using food, and many studies that, you know, I'm sure you're aware of for MS and all diseases are drug-based?
The good news is we are slowly getting more studies about food. Food studies are much harder than drug studies, because a drug, I'm just going to get you to come in, take the infusion or the pill, and you won't know if you're on the active or the placebo. If you're on a food study, you'll know what you're eating. You're going to know that you're in the intervention arm or you're in the control arm. And we're going to have you change what you're eating, give up foods that are familiar, learn new foods. It's a very big ask. Mm-hmm. So they're more expensive and they're much harder to conduct.
Have you seen, there's a documentary out now. It's involving, what is the name of it? It's escaped me at this moment. It's about a number, it's I think 26 identical twins, and they put them on a vegan diet versus more of a Mediterranean diet, and then track them through DEXA scans, weight, cardiovascular risks. It's on Netflix right now. It's escaping me.
I'll have to check that out.
Well, it's quite interesting, because at the end, they bring them back, and same thing, they had to be randomized and you know, some of them were already vegan and they had to move to the meat. It was kind of interesting. And in the first couple of weeks, they actually sent them food. Then they taught them how to cook. And then they were completely on their own. The interesting thing is that, well, not probably to you and me interesting, but both of arms lost weight, but the vegans lost most of their weight in their muscle. They lost it as their muscles. They were not getting enough protein. But then the end of the documentary goes on to sort of promote a vegan diet by saying their cardiovascular risks were lower, their various other things. It's really mostly focused on cardiovascular risks were lower with this vegan diet. And so even though the siblings that were in the Mediterranean diet were then now saying, oh, I might want to become a vegan now. And I was thinking to myself, well, 10 minutes ago in the documentary, we just discussed how the vegan lost 4 pounds, but 3 of it was muscle breakdown. So it was kind of a little
long-term, pretty negative consequence.
Right. They didn't quite bring that into the conclusion, which was kind of interesting.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the conflicts of interest that happen these days with many studies.
There's a conflict of interest committee here at the university. So every time we do a research, we have to disclose, is there a potential conflict of interest, a perceived conflict of interest, which I do. Then I have to fill out a form which explains why I would do the research, how we control for that. Then the committee has, they discuss, impose a plan. I have to sign off on it. My department chair signs off on it. And we do that for drug devices. And then we do it because I've written books.
Right. Well, tell me, so we've been spending a lot of time on food. And clearly that is a huge portion, as we both know, of root cause for autoimmunity. But what are some things someone newly diagnosed with MS, they're going to go on the Walls protocol diet. What else can they do? I mean, I know some of the things that you do. Yeah. I've introduced you to Garrett with the New Fit. I see you on Instagram and things in your endless pool.
Yeah.
What are some other things besides diet that those with MS can do to keep muscle, gain muscle?
I think strength training is super helpful. You want to have plenty of muscle. Aerobic exercise is good. Balance training, super helpful. And so I do balance training every day after my shower. Meditation, mindfulness, time in nature, connection. Do you have friends? Do you have a spiritual practice or a religious practice? How often are you just sitting outside? So there are many different facets of self-care, of wellness care. You don't have to do all of it every day, but I encourage you to begin exploring what you could begin adding.
And I'm sure no 2 days are always alike, but what is a typical day for you?
So this morning I was up at 5:30, I meditate. Then I came in, I did a strength training session and I did it with blood flow restriction bands. So when I add those, like, oh my God, that really adds to the intensity of it. And then I go do a red light sauna and I'm taking my dog in my sauna with me. So my dog's enjoying the sauna. Then I go out in the snow after the sauna for a little cold therapy. Then I come back and do my cold shower. And then I start my day doing work. Today is about 8:25. So that was about a 3-hour morning ritual of self-care. Of course, now everyone is listening like, oh my God, I couldn't possibly spend 3 hours of self-care. I assure you, I didn't in the beginning either. You just gradually figure out what you could begin adding and fitting into your day. And I don't always do a 3-hour routine. Some days, you know, I sleep until 7:30 and maybe only do a half hour sauna. And I'm just going to do some walks during the day. So it fluctuates day to day. I also have not eaten. I did a protein smoothie after my strength training. I've not eaten yet. I'll have a big chicken salad and a bunch of sauerkraut tonight for supper. And then my daughter and I are going to play a Sherlock board game that usually will take us about another 2 hours tonight. A lot of problem solving. That's a very interesting game that we both enjoy. So you have some social bonding, problem solving, cluing. So it's a great cognitive stressor and lots of fun.
And when you're traveling or you have a really busy day, do you have some non-negotiables, and what are they? Is it always meditation? Is it always a walk? What are the non-negotiables for you?
I have to have some physical activity. So at the very least, I'm going to do my balance training. I think that particularly when you're in the second over the age of 50 for MS, balance training is so powerful and it doesn't take much time to do. And so I like to do that. And I really like to wind down and have a gratitude practice to fall asleep by.
Awesome.
I suppose the other thing is, I have to be so careful about what I eat. If I have any gluten, dairy, or eggs, it will trigger my face pain.
Oh, wow.
And so trigeminal neuralgia is so brutal. It is, I'm like, I'm just so careful about what I'm eating. And if there's concern, I will fast. I'll just have tea.
And on a different note, just the trigeminal neuralgia made me think of it, is have you seen an uptick in symptoms or flares, perhaps is a better word for those with MS, after having COVID or having the vaccine? Yeah. Because I have a friend
absolutely.
Who has MS, and he had big flares after having it and then mentioned.
And it takes it longer to clear. So you get a flare, that's a pseudorelapse, and then it will take many months to get back to baseline. And we know long COVID is really autoimmune processes that are increased. You know, and I should mention that we have a long COVID study. So if there are people listening who have long COVID, please email us at aims-studies@uiowa.edu. And we can get you the link to screen for that study.
Yeah, please do. And we'll get that in the show notes as well. I hadn't heard you mention in your arsenal of things that you use personally, hyperbaric oxygen. I've personally found that very helpful for myself with autoimmunity, many people in my clinic. And then when I had COVID, I was having severe fatigue a few weeks later and concerned I might get long COVID. So I hopped in the hyperbarics, and in a couple sessions, it was gone.
I have not had any personal experience with hyperbaric. It's certainly an adjunct. I had COVID too, as I'd gone to a scientific conference in Las Vegas and came back and had COVID a few days later. And it took me a couple weeks to recover from that. And I was like, okay, well, if things don't get quickly resolved here, I'll be checking out the hyperbaric. Unfortunately, I'm back strength training and doing my aerobic.
Great. What do you see on the horizon? Are there new drugs following your programming?
There are millions, or actually probably billions of dollars being spent on remyelination drugs, which work great in mice and in rats and have either no effect or tiny, tiny effect in humans. And so as a result, we ended up making a remyelination course for my people and a restoring function course that's been super helpful to help people understand that we know a lot about why myelin repair fails. We have learned a lot through the mouse models. And then using my functional medicine's perspective, I'm like, okay, so we could use all of that. And now here are my thoughts on how you better improve your ability to repair your myelin. And that's been very helpful. In fact, I'm talking with my team about what we might do next with that to make that course more widely available.
Awesome. And yeah, I just have to tell you, I was thinking about Christina Applegate. I mean, because there's all this news, I think the Golden Globes, and maybe she was there. Has anybody from her team reached out? She needs to know you.
Oh, I know. And we have many well-known actors and actresses that have MS who sort of reach out to us, and we're happy to chat with them. But the reality
it's too
is
intense.
Behavior change is hard. And without the support of the family and the medical team, they're like, easier to just take the DMTs and accept the limitations.
I was traveling on a plane not too long ago, and the woman was one seat over from me, and her bag fell, and it was all these prescriptions. And she brought up that she had MS. And I, so of course, mentioned you and mentioned my book, and you can just see the glazing over. When she's like, oh, is she something? And I was like, oh, no, it's really a diet and lifestyle intervention. And then she just completely was doing anything she could to just kind of shift over, get away from me, like not interested. Meanwhile, dumping over her bag full of orange-brown prescription bottles.
And what is really hard is if the spouse really wants to embrace all of that, the patient doesn't want to, so the spouse reaches out to me, and I'm like, the best thing you could do is you yourself could embrace the diet and lifestyle and let them see how easy it could happen to see the transformation in your life and let them be curious. And then they may embrace it or they may not, but you can't control them. You can only control your own actions.
Yeah, it's very difficult seeing a loved one make a different choice than you would make. And I remember when I was practicing, a lot of people saying, oh, I have to give this up or I have to give that up. It's like, but when you feel so much better, it's not even giving it up. You enjoy it and you feel better, and that way outweighs that. Or you could be on drugs that my father, I was able to help him. He had polymyositis, and I was able to get him off all of his drugs. And he was on CellCept and methotrexate and all of it. And then he had a flare, and I was dealing with the toxic mold exposure, and he went back on his drugs. And within 6 months, he was in the hospital with sepsis in the ICU and, you know, eventually passed away. So it's like either you can take these dietary lifestyle interventions that for many, many, many people work, or these drugs that leave you open to exposure.
A lot more vulnerable.
Yeah.
And will also lead to accelerated aging. The autoimmune diseases is part of accelerated aging, certainly MS, that accelerates aging. And then you take the DMTs, which accelerates aging a little further, or you embrace the diet and lifestyle changes that are associated with accelerated health. And what we saw at the VA, I see in my clinics, and we see in our clinical trials, is people come in and they look younger and younger. And so now we are saying, be sure you take a photo of yourself and do a little video of your hopes and dreams right now, because we predict that you will see in the next year a much younger person looking back at you.
Awesome. Well, before we part, I like to ask guests, what are three things that you can recommend to our listeners right now that they can do tomorrow to take back their health?
Well, one is follow me on Instagram so you get to see what I'm eating and doing. That is super fun.
Definitely make liver look good.
Yeah, liver can be so yummy. Know your why. If your home was being to have smoke roll out of the windows, who or what would you rush into the house to save? Because it creating new habits, new diet and lifestyle does take some effort. And if you know you're doing this because you want to be there more effectively for your children or your grandchildren or your spouse, it's a whole lot easier when you have that mental clarity. And then I invite you, before, as you fall asleep at night, visualize someone or a place for which you are grateful so you can fall asleep to some gratitude in your heart.
Those are excellent. Easy, free suggestions.
Free stuff.
So I appreciate
it. And go sit outside.
Yes. Yes.
Ideally take a walk, but at the very least, you know, just please just sit on your deck, sit on the sidewalk, or sit in a chair next to the sidewalk. Be outside.
Well, excellent. Thank you very much, Dr. Terry Walls. We will have all your information in the show notes, but if you would like to share how people can find you and follow you, we welcome
that. Yeah, so my webpage, terrywalls.com, if you go to terrywalls.com/MS study, you can screen for the study. terrywalls.com/diet, you'll get a cheat sheet. My Instagram is Dr. Dr. Terry Walls, T-E-R-R-Y, Walls, W-A-H-L-S.
Awesome. Well, I really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much. And I hope that our listeners have learned something from you today.
Wonderful. Thanks, Amy.
Bye. I want to thank this week's guests for sharing their time and knowledge, and thank you for listening. To read the full show notes for each episode, which include a summary, timestamp, quotes, and any resources mentioned, please visit amymyersmd.com/podcast. Lastly, if you've enjoyed this episode, I'd love if you would leave a rating and a review on Apple or Spotify, and we'll select a few to read out loud in a future episode. Tune in next week to hear from another inspiring guest as we help you take back your health.